Welcome to Legend Lore with Luis and Lauren, where we talk about Pathfinder 2nd Edition.
I'm Luis, and I'm a developer at Paizo working on the Pathfinder Lost Omens line. I've been playing tabletop RPGs for over 15 years, and I've written for dozens of Pathfinder products. I'm also the GM for Valiant, and I write the Monsters Physique blog here on the No Direction Network.
And I'm Lauren, and I'm realizing that I'm getting old now that I've been playing RPGs for 20 years. You can also watch me play in the Adventures and Three Ring Adventure podcast. And this week, oh my god, it's part three of the Mwangi Expanse. Luis, will we ever be done with the Mwangi Expanse?
We are stuck in the depths of the Mwangi Expanse, lost in the jungles, like any would-be adventurer. But before we make our way through the Mwangi Expanse a bit more, I do want to say that although we know a lot about what we're talking about when it comes to Pathfinder, we want to remind you that we're not providing any kind of official answers. We're here to offer advice, and you can use that however you like. Remember that the official word from Paizo is the only official ruling out there, but don't forget, it's your game. Do what works best for your table.
Now, last we left the Mwangi Expanse, we were talking about the different ethnic groups of a lot of the core rule book races and our ancestries.
Yes.
Today we're gonna start with the new ancestries that are coming from the Mwangi Expanse. We're gonna talk a little bit about some of the new gods and some of our favorites and some of our favorites in the bestiary. And then I think if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about the Magic Warrior. But first up on the slate is a very unique race, mm-hmm. a very unique ancestry. And I think that's going to kind of be a theme that going forward. We've got the Anandi. Luis, please tell me about the Anandi.
So the Anandi people are spiders. They're big spiders, like spiders the size of a big dog. They're medium-sized spiders in terms of game mechanics. Yeah, they're these spider people that have existed for a very long time, and when they try to set out into the world, they realize a lot of people were freaked out by them because they're big spiders, and a lot of people aren't into that. Even if you're okay with spiders, seeing a really big one might freak you out. So wouldn't you know it, Anandi people soon learned, all right, well, we got to figure out a way to maybe try to be able to speak with other people but not freak them out, and they learned how to weave magic around them in such a way that they learned to change their shape to take on human appearances as well as their spider appearance. So whenever they go out into the world, they usually do so under the guise of a human, but you know, any human you meet out there, especially in the Mwangi Expanse, might be a person that can actually turn back into a spider at any time. But they are weavers of magic. They're very good at illusion magic, and well, like spiders, like you would expect. They can climb around and spin webs and stuff too. So they're kind people. They just want to be your friend, but recognize that it might be hard to be friends with the big spider.
And I like that the default picture of them, or the very first picture that you see for the Anandi, is a peacock spider.
Yeah.
Like, of all the spiders they could pick, they were like, which one would be the least intimidating? Let's go with the cute peacock spider. Dance, dance, dance. Butt shuffle. You know, it was very cute.
Do be aware that if an Anandi is doing a dance and a butt shuffle at you, it means they're interested, so. Like real spiders. They're trying to attract a mate or a partner.
And then just like any other ancestor, we have a few different specific heritages or a few different kinds of Anandi that you can be. The first one is the adaptive Anandi, or Anandi. I'm gonna mess that up. It's going to be Anandi all day. The adaptive one, so they're not necessarily blending in with a human society. Maybe this is an Anandi that grew up in a dwarven society, and their humanoid form is that of a dwarf. Or you've got the polychromatic Anandi, where you're even more bright and even more colorful. So you become trained in performance, and you have the impressive performance feat, because people are going to watch that butt wiggle.
Yeah. Anandi have fangs as an unarmed attack, and if you are a snaring Anandi, your fangs also gain the grapple and trip traits, making you particularly potent in combat with your fangs. And the spindly Anandi skitters around a lot faster and increases their movement speed to 30 feet.
You know, both the snaring Anati and the venomous Anati, which has, you know, its own kind of venom. Those would be really interesting monks, you know. I'm going to have to play with some builds like that, because I think that'd be really neat to just, especially the snaring one, you just put the grapple and trip traits on all of those normal monk attacks. I think that'd be pretty cool.
I think a monk has lots of fun ancestries to pick from, and Anati, I think, are particularly interesting once you get things like your climb speed and stuff as well.
Now, Luis, what's kind of the theme of some of the ancestry feats that you'll find?
One of the themes is magic. I mean, Anati are known magic users, and depending on your ancestry feats, you might gain cantrips and illusion magic and the like. As well, so, you know, if you want to lean into some magic, whether or not you are a spellcaster, you can get some of that through your Anati feats.
I also see a lot of good, like, spidery combat ones, like that improves your fangs or your venom or your web, maybe.
Yeah, and I guess the other big thing is your hybrid form. So an Anati has two forms. They have their spider form, which is their original form, their base form, and then they can change shape into a humanoid form, which typically is a human or, you know, dwarf or whatever. But in spider form, you just have big spider legs, which make it really hard to do stuff. You don't have thumbs and fingers to be very dexterous with. And going into hybrid shape gives you the best of both worlds in that you can have your spider abilities available, but then have hands and everything to do stuff with like you would in your human form. So you get to take advantage of both of your forms in both of your forms at once.
So you can have your spider cake and eat it too? Mmm, spider cake.
Which, is that a cake baked by a spider? Or is that a spider, or is that a cake? No, I'm just going to say...
It's a cake full of spiders. I'm letting you know right now, it is a cake full of spiders. I'm really excited to talk about and hear about the next one, especially from you, because the Konrasu is just so mysterious. Like, what is the deal with these guys?
Oh, boy. So if you go back to the very first Lost Omens release, Lost Omens World Guide, and look through, I think it's just right in the intro section that talks about the Mwangi Expanse region. It mentions the Magambia, and it says, hey, there's lots of different ancestries and people that come to hang out at the Magambia. It includes people like Anati, and then it name drops a couple of others, like the Aeon worshipping Konrasu with their wooden exoskeletons, or the bone-feathered Shisk, or the mini-eyed Galoma. And that was a sentence that name-dropped a bunch of different peoples that had never existed before, and we didn't know what they were. The author for that's just like, hey, I think it'd be cool to just tee up the idea of a couple of new ancestries. I'll put them in here. Great. We have one sentence to work from for each of these new ancestries. And well, here is the Konrasu ancestry, which came about from that one sentence. So we know that they worship Aeons and they have wooden exoskeletons. And from there, when we assigned the book, we asked our freelancer, take that sentence and run with it, figure it out. And now we have here the proper ancestry, which are shards of like cosmic existence that have gained sentience and are looking to interface with the rest of the universe. So they do so by creating, growing wooden bodies around them so they have something to use to touch and feel and move around and stuff.
Yeah, I absolutely love this idea for a Konrasu character to have, where they're growing their wooden body, but they're doing it like through a skeleton that they found, you know, and they're kind of like animating this skeleton with like vines and stuff coming out of it. I really want to play that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean,
they're probably the weirdest.
Someone meet.
They're probably the weirdest ancestry we've shown off so far. Where would someone meet at Konrasu?
Where would someone meet at Konrasu?
Well, it turns out in the Mwangi Expanse is where you meet at Konrasu. They are rare. So even within the Mwangi Expanse, you're not going to see them very often. I'm going to guess, most likely, in places that have connections to planar magic. So some place like the Magambia will probably have that. Or places with like safe groves where they can grow their bodies. You're not going to just find a Kunrasu growing willy-nilly in the middle of the jungle because any creature could come by and maybe disrupt the growing rites and rituals that they undergo to grow their bodies and stuff. So, probably a cosmopolitan metropolitan area. Magambia is maybe your best bet for that. Or, somewhere else around the plains might be kind of fun. You might see them on the plane of access as well.
Now, speaking of the different rites of growing and whatnot, the different rites that are specific to that Conrasu kind of makes up the Conrasu heritages. So, for example, if you were born of the rite of knowing, right, your exoskeleton has a special connection with the plane of access, letting you call to access to, get a better chance to recall knowledge.
One of the big Kunrasu abilities is the fact that because they're plants, they can sit in sunlight for 10 minutes and heal up. And normally, it just heals themselves when they do that. But if you undergo the rite of light, you can share your sunlight healing and heal an ally. And each ally can get healed once per day with that rite of light, which is pretty nice.
With the rite of passage, you're kind of more symbiotic with the wood that you and the plants that you've grown around you, and it lets you ignore difficult terrain and uneven ground caused by undergrowth.
And finally, the rite of reinforcement, which is the first time we've seen something like this. It's you have a built-in set of armor. Basically, have living breastplate armor attached to you that you can't remove, but you never have to worry about sleeping in it and stuff. And you can upgrade it as if it were armor because your exoskeleton is so tough. It works just like armor.
And what's interesting to note on that doesn't necessarily give you
No,
proficiency with
it
medium
doesn't.
armor. So make sure you, so pick a class appropriately, because that would be hilarious if you're just like, wait, I can't
Yeah,
use
and
this.
I know I've seen people ask, like, why didn't we give you proficiency with that? And I think that the answer is, I think it's very clear that if you're going to want to use that armor, you're going to want to make sure you have proficiency. So you'll take a class that does it. I mean, you don't just take that willy-nilly to be like, ah, oh, look, I'm a wizard with medium armor. Ha ha ha.
Yeah, I do think that if that gave you the proficiency, it
I
might
think
be a
it'd be a
little
little strong,
strong.
yeah.
And so the last one is the rite of invocation, where your exoskeleton made of trees is also infused with magic, and you get an arcane or an occult cantrip.
Have you checked out the Kunrasu feats, Lauren?
I looked at him a little bit while I was playing around with my skeleton Conrasu fighter idea, and I do kind of like the Ceremony of Protection one, because it's kind of just like
It's a free
I
shield.
don't know. It's like a free shield, but I need to look at him a little bit more, before I really decide what I'm gonna. Oh, I remember what I liked. It's because that one turns into some other things, doesn't it? Yeah, Ceremony of Fortification later. Where you get resistance to bludgeoning and stuff?
Yes,
Yeah,
yeah.
I do like it.
Another theme here. One of the themes you'll notice when looking at these feats is that pretty much they all have the name of Ceremony of X, which I think is a fun little bit of flavor that you kind of undergo this ritual or perform the ceremony to change your body in such a way to get this extra cool ability. I think the really cool thing is all of the sunlight healing related feats. Normally, you can only heal yourself once per day, and it heals you a number of d8 equal to half your level. So, kind of like the heal spell, but later you can reinforce it so you get a d8 per level, so you could get up to 20 d8 and change it. So, you can, in theory, eventually by 17th level, you can heal yourself as many times as you want. As long as you're willing to take 10 minutes every time to do it, you can heal yourself infinitely, which is pretty cool, I think.
As long as you have access to the sun.
Yes, as long as you have access to the sun.
You're not like underground doing the Underdark and stuff. Next ancestor is one I'm really excited about. I have always been a big fan of the Gnoll. And this is where they're finally getting their debut in second edition, even though they're not exclusively a Mwangi Expanse type thing.
Correct. You might be familiar with gnolls as a monster that you fight against. And that's still true. There are still gnolls out there that are doing evil stuff and might be the type that adventurers need to put a stop to stuff. But the gnolls in the Mwangi Expanse, a lot of them are just living their lives, doing whatever they want. Most of them are chaotic neutral more than they are evil or anything, just enjoying life out there. So the Mwangi Gnolls, who call themselves Kolo, like to just live their lives and honor their ancestors and kind of use. They might have strange rituals and customs, like if they have a family member or a friend that was very important to them and they want to honor them, when they die, they will eat their bodies to be like, hey, you were great. We loved, how kind you were or something, or how great you were in battle. And we hope to have your legacy live on through us, and we'll eat you, and maybe we'll get some of your kindness and your strength and stuff, and then get to share that with the rest of everyone else. And boy, if that isn't a weird thing to think about if you're not used to something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, this should be based on some real cultural rituals, isn't it?
I think there's a lot of the author for this grabbed a lot of folklore and mythology to come up with some of these ideas, just to be like, hyenas are obviously the inspiration for gnolls, but they're not always just seen as like these evil creatures all the time. So, what cool stuff can we add to them that may not necessarily be the prettiest or the something that comes to mind is, oh, that's so nice, but it's still interesting and not necessarily just like an evil thing, like, ah, they're all slavers, blah, blah, blah.
I don't know why. I've just always found gnolls to kind of be interesting, even back from second edition D&D games, where they were just kind of a neat monster, a neat little mook to throw at your players to be different from bandits or orcs. One of the gnoll heritage is that kind of changes the mold a little bit is the ant gnoll, which where you're just like a small size gnoll, so you're like a different breed or like a puppy breed of gnoll, and that's pretty neat.
The fun thing about the ant gnoll is, although you're small, it doesn't make any changes to your ability boosts or your ability flaws. So you're small and still get a strength boost. So you're just a tough little gnoll, which is great. And then, speaking of the opposite end, you can be a great gnoll, which is kind of really big for their size. They're still medium, but they get 10 hit points instead of 8, and a bonus to shove and trip people.
I'm very intrigued by the sweet breath gnoll, because what a wild concept that is. Your breath just smells so good that it can entrance your prey.
Yeah, and that's the thing that was pulled from folklore, is that there are some stories that say if a hyena breathes into your face and you smell that, it can hypnotize you. So just a fun little nod to mythology. And finally, the witch knoll, which lets you kind of do the cliche hyena laugh thing by using ghost sound to trick people.
Very cool. So what kind of ancestry feats are we going to see for the gnolls?
There's a lot of stuff for helping you enhance your bite. Of course, more stuff for your unarmed attacks. But I think one cool thing is the different pack or related stuff.
That's what I was looking at
Gnolls
too.
work together in packs. So there's a few feats for fighting with your allies and improving aid and things like that. So that's pretty nice. And then there's really weird ones like the right hand blood, which is another thing pulled from folklore that said that blood from the right side of a hyena can heal, but the left side is poisonous. So you can use your right half of your body's blood to try to treat wounds and treat disease and stuff, which is nothing I had ever heard of until our freelancer turned it in and said, look, here's all this cool stuff from mythology.
I remember reading that and thinking, yeah, this is definitely from real mythology because it is too creative not to be. It was so good. And then I love all the ancestor worship in here too, like your grandmother's wisdom where you carry her bones, or you've got ancestor's rage. I just think they did such a good job just making this feel like a gnoll, but also like deeply cultural too, you know? I just love giving these. Anyway, on to the Goloma. Because I'm excited. when I tell people, yeah, we've got all these cool new ancestries in from the Mwangi Expanse. Here's a horse bug. Like, how do you describe the Galoma?
Horse bug, I think, is maybe the closest thing I've seen. There's a lot of people relating them to the Xenomorphs from Alien because of their head shape and stuff. But yeah, trying to describe this artwork is really tough. Imagine a human person to start with. Give them claws, clawed feet. Give them a weird chitinous horse head that has way too many eyes on it. And then it has like this bushy mane of hair, but it turns out those hairs are actually just little extensions with additional eyes. which is just the weirdest looking thing. If someone were to put this picture up, I'd be like, oh yeah, that's a monster you have to kill. That's a demon or something, right?
Yeah, demon.
But good. It turns out they're like big scaredy cat people. They're afraid of a lot of things. The lore is here that way back in the day around Earthfall, people started hunting Galoma, and you know, they fled for their lives and lived in fear for a long time and slowly changed to live a life in such a way that they're always aware of predators and anyone who'd come to attack them. So that's why they have so many eyes all over the place, so they can see in every direction. And because of that, they're very good at noticing particular details. They're good at keeping aware of like large masses of people trying to ambush them. But they're used to large groups coming after them rather than individuals, so it's hard for them to actually discern individual threats. Like a single person stalking them would have a better time than a whole group trying to ambush them, because of the way their brains have been wired to be afraid of large groups coming down to attack them.
I like how all of them have innately the eyes in the back ability, which lets them, when they seek, they can seek in two different places at once. Which I think is a really interesting way to tie in that mechanic that their eyes just surround their entire head.
Yeah, there was a bit of talk about trying to give them all-around vision just out the gate, but we realized that's probably a bit too much. But yeah, eyes in the back, I think, kind of gives you that feel of all-around vision without strictly giving it to you right away. Because you can take the feat later to eventually get something like that.
Now, where might one find a Galoma?
Good luck finding Galoma, because they're always hiding. If you're lucky, you can maybe find a Galoma settlement deep in the depths of the jungle or up in the mountains and stuff. But on their own, you'd have to have a pretty brave Galoma or be in a place where a Galoma feels very, very safe. Again, the Ntambu and the Mugambi is probably the safest spot in all of Mwangi Expanse. So that's maybe your best shot of finding one just out in the open. But otherwise, you're probably not going to find Galoma out there. That's why they're considered rare.
So the first of the Galoma heritage that we have is the Farsight Galoma, where you basically just get low light vision because your eyes are so much better. Or the Frightful Galoma, where your face is particularly scary, which doesn't make sense to me because, like, the default picture is already particularly scary. Like, God, and then you turn to the next page and you see that white Galoma with the red eyes. Oof, he's got to be the frightful one. Anyway, yeah, you get intimidation and intimidating glare. Yes.
You might be an insightful Galoma who's pretty good at noticing when people are lying stuff, so you get bonuses to sense motive. Or you could be a vicious Galoma, which... you've decided to fight back. Your claws have grown strong enough to attack people, and you get a claw unarmed attack.
The Vigilant Galoma. You know, you're like, okay, so historically we've had all these enemies, right? And we're all good at, you know, looking at groups coming at us. But the Vigilant Galoma is like, yeah, but we also got to know about magic threats coming at us. So they all get Detect Magic as an arcane cantrip.
Yeah, and then looking at their different feats, a lot of it is just what cool stuff can their eyes do? so some of that might be able to count things very quickly and notice details. Some of it eventually lets you do things like gain all around vision. As an action, you can spend an action to kind of focus and gain that all around vision. Or eventually upgrade it so it's always on. And eventually their eyes can pierce through even magical effects, and they get the ability to use true seeing whenever they look around, which is pretty cool, if you ask me.
I do. If you asked me, I'd also say that that's pretty cool. Now, one of the things I remember running into a lot in Pathfinder Society back in first edition is a lot of the people in our lodge were playing Gripplies. So it's kind of neat to see them fleshed out in this book now.
Well, Gripplies are super cute, and they're cool frogs. Like, what? Why wouldn't you want to play a Gripply, right?
Yeah, other than that, I kind of don't know anything about them. Like, what's the deal with Gripplies?
What's
You
the
know?
deal with Gripplies? What's the deal with these frogs? The Gripply societies tend to live up in trees and stuff where they can climb around, jump around. And I don't know, they're just cool little frogs. They live relatively simpler lives. They enjoy like going around fishing and hunting and stuff. They're not too concerned about magic or technology. Not to say that they're like not intelligent or anything. They just are happy with their lives. They're kind of more rural style lifestyle for them compared to some of the other ancestries. Yeah, they're great hunters, they're great jumpers, and the cute little frogs. What more do you want?
I do get kind of like the swamp feeling from the Gripplies. Yeah, more so than like say like the deep jungles that you typically would think of in the Mwangi Expanse. And then of course, because we're frogs and tree frogs, we have to have the poison hide Gripply, where your skin is literally toxic.
Yes.
Snap tongue Gripply gives you that long frog tongue. You whip it out and you grab your prey with it.
It could be a sticky toe Gripply, which is used to adhering to stuff because of the way their skin works, and it gives you bonuses to avoid being pushed around, and climbing is a lot easier for you. Or you can be a windweb Gripply who has like particularly wide webbing between their toes that lets them fall slower as they catch the wind, which is a heck of an image in my head, like seeing a frog just kind of flying squirrel style glide down a tree.
Oh, and the best part about this is it says as long as you have one hand free, you can do this. So now you have to imagine each hand, the digits are long enough and the webbing is enough. Each hand is like a little
Oh, yes.
parachute. What? What? How big is that hand?
Or it might just be that Gripplies are very light, you know?
Oh, that could be. They could have like, hollow bones of a bird.
So Gripplies are pretty good at jumping around and using their tongues. Who would have guessed?
Yeah, but what kind of feats are they good at picking up?
Oh, well, that's what I'm saying. Their feet are pretty good at helping you jump around and use your tongue.
Who'd have thunk it?
Who would have thought? There's a cool set of feats, like I think Ricocheting Leap is pretty fun, that lets you kind of do wall jumps off of stuff, or jump off of people to get around in combat, which is pretty fun. If you have a useful Gripply tongue, you can use it to hit people from further away with reach. And even eventually, like, disarm people with your tongue and stuff like that. It's pretty fun. Pretty fun little frog things.
It'd be another neat thing to start doing monk stuff with, like a tongue monk.
And I want to point out in particular, if you're looking through the book, the last page on the Gripply section has a picture of their homes. All of these have had a picture of a building, like a home for the different ancestries, but I particularly like the Gripply ones that are just hanging up from a tree. Looks like a real cool place to hang out.
It does look super cozy. I can definitely imagine sitting on that porch and drinking fly coffee?
Fly tea.
Fly tea? Oh, there you go. Bug gut tea.
Bug gut tea.
Next, we come with the extremely mysterious Shisk, which I have now learned is a product of just having one sentence about.
Yeah, we kind of just figured out, well, here we're going to hand it again off to the freelancer and see what happens. And we have Shis, who are, like, interestingly, like, in a very Star Wars kind of feel, the information broker style ancestry. They're very good at gathering information and keeping knowledge and stuff. Star Wars seems to have a lot of those, where there's just like this one species is good at X thing and this other species is good at Y thing. And Shis is, I think, the closest thing we've ever had to that, where they live underground and are very good at gathering knowledge and retaining knowledge and stuff. And just learning about things. And because they're rare, they you don't get to see them very often, but when you do meet them, you get to learn a lot because their culture is all about just learning as much as they can and keeping track of all this knowledge that they have. Oh, also, if you look at the picture, they happen to have like these weird bone quill feather things sticking out of them, which is something. They look kind of like porcupine people. They can also use those in combat and stuff to defend themselves.
So, do you think, so would you say that in the Mwangi Expanse, you'd find Shis, like, in, like, caves and stuff? Like, you think that that's where they'd live?
Yeah, mountains and caves and stuff, yeah.
So, the first of the Shis caretages that is presented in the book is the Lorekeeper Shisk. What I really like about this is that you pick one lore skill and any other intelligence or wisdom-based skill at your choice. You become trained in it, but then, at fifth level, you also become an expert in those chosen skills. I think this is fantastic because this reminds me of my favorite skill feat in the game, additional lore. There's so many cool lore skills or things you're like, I want to be good at sailing. But in your build, you don't have enough time to keep leveling up sailing. So this kind of helps it level up with you. And I think it's awesome.
Yeah, and there's not too many feats out there that... I feel like there's a fair number of feats that scale lore up with you. Which is, you know, whatever, lores can be useful or not, depending. But a different skill, like an intelligence or wisdom-based skill, so something like Arcana or Occultism that scales up a bit automatically, it's not anything you really see anywhere, so that's pretty neat.
Yeah. Now, Luis, don't you have some thoughts about scaling up lores?
I do about lores. I think additional lore is great. I think it works great. And I think... if you were to apply that same logic where, you know, at the minimum level, at what, 3rd, 7th, and 15th level, you automatically go up in proficiency, you should apply that same logic to your background lore that you get. So if you get baking lore from something, from your background or whatever, or warfare lore or whatever, that should probably go up as well. I think that would make every background a bit more exciting, if you ask me.
I tend to agree. The first time you said this, I was like, my mind was almost blown. I was like, whoa, I need to do that. So that's what I'm doing now in my home game, our Reign of Winter as second edition game. I think I'm going to level up the players probably on Wednesday, probably after the next boss fight. And I'm definitely going to have them level up their lore skill from the background with them because I think that's great. I think it needs to be that way. It's one of those homebrew / variant rules that should probably kind of just be default.
Yes.
But anyway, speaking of Shisks, next we have the Quillcoat Shisk.
Yeah, Quillcoat Shisks take advantage of their bone feathers, quill things. If you get struck as a reaction once per day, you can kind of dig a quill into your attacker, which can be pretty nasty, especially on a crit because it deals persistent bleed damage. And the damage from your barbed quill does scale up pretty well, actually. I think eventually you're doing up to 10d8 on a reaction, which is quite a bit.
The Spellkeeper Shisk is very similar to that magic-infused Konrasu, where you can pick one cantrip. This time it has to be from the Primal or the Occult spell list, and you get that cantrip many times as you want per day.
Mm-hmm. The lore for the Shisk, if you check it out, mentions that they have a low-calorie diet. They just kind of subsist on vegetables and a few other things and don't eat very much. And if you are a strong gut Shisk, you eat less than anyone else even. You can go a whole week without needing food, which is pretty useful for a kind of survival, exploration, travel campaign in places like maybe the Mwangi Expanse. And additionally, your low metabolism means that you take longer to be affected by diseases and poisons, which can be pretty nice.
The last shisk that we're going to talk about today, because it's the last one in the book, is the Stone Step Shisk. That's kind of hard to say. Stone Step Shisk. You know, I feel that's one of those. If you try to do it three times real fast, it would just fail. Do you want to find out? Let's find out.
No.
Stone Step Shisk, Stone Step Shisk, Stone Step Shisk. Okay. All right, Luis,
Yes,
go. Your turn.
Stone Step Shisk, Stone Step Shisk, Stone Step Shisk.
Oh, damn, you were good. Okay. So, you know, they live in the caves and the mountains, and, you know, these in particular are good at navigating in the caves and the mountains because they ignore non-magical diff terrain that's caused by, like, rubble and uneven ground and stuff. Yeah. But what kind of, like, you know, feats are Shisks going to be choosing from?
You have two particular themes of feats. The first is all the lore stuff. You can take a bunch of different feats to help you recall knowledge and learn stuff and get a feel for the world around you and remembering things. So like the eidetic ear helps you remember sounds and stuff. You can use the dig up secrets feat to give you the hypercognition spell, which lets you recall knowledge a bunch. And eventually at 17th level with Fountain of Secrets, you can basically once per round, every round for as long as you want, just recall knowledge for free, which is pretty crazy.
One of the things that I think is really exciting about the Mwangi Expanse book is how well fleshed out the new deities are. Like, when I first opened up the book, my very first initial impression is like, oh boy, here's some new deities, whatever. But then I started reading through them, and I'm like, these are actually really cool. And, like, they're really unique. They have some interesting ideas behind them. Luis, what is the design philosophy behind these new deities?
Well, a lot of these deities were already established in lore. So gods like Angazan and the old sun gods and Grandmother Spider were already mentioned in other products, and we just kind of, brought them over. That's a good chunk of them here. A lot of the rest of these, we just asked the freelancers, give us gods that you think fit. I think we may have given them some examples of folklore deities or folklore beings that might work as inspiration, but for the most part, they were just brand new stuff. I think the only ones that I can think of that were a particular request, I think, might have been Uvuku, which we wanted because there's a lot of cloud dragon stuff going on, so a cloud dragon god made sense. And the other one would have been Adanye. A quick story about Adanye. Adanye first came about because Eleanor, the other developer on this, was part of my Return of the Rune Lords campaign as a catfolk paladin who needed a deity. And we just suggested, oh, maybe there should be a catfolk deity. And she came up with the idea for Adanye and just had like a little sticky note with domains and like alignment and a few ideas and then just kind of role played it all out herself. And then we handed those notes and ideas that she had off to the freelancer. And that's how we came up with Adanye. It was part of a game that evolved and got kind of promoted into official lore and canon.
Adanye, the cat goddess of warm naps in front of a cozy fire.
Yes, of chilling out and having a nice time at home.
Which is a very big contrast to, I think, my favorite of the new gods from this book, Calicot. This guy looks
Yes.
so terrifying, and from what I understand, he's like. So if Lamashtu is like the mother of monsters, right? And for all these people in the outskirts of society who are like maybe deformed or for some reason society just looks down on them as less than or subhuman, Lamashtu's like, I will take you in. Go commit evil in my name, right? But Calcott's like, no. I will take you in. But protect people, you know? Is that right? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, exactly. We saw that Lamashtu was and putting herself forth as the champion of the downtrodden because of physical disabilities and other stuff like that that many people would consider quote unquote monstrous. And that's fine. We like the idea of having someone for, maybe there's a god that does look out for you, but we didn't necessarily want it to always just be the evil god. So that's how we came up with Calicot. I think Eleanor did the part in making Calicot come to life here. And really pushing forth the idea that yes, people look different and there might be differences in that, and that's okay. I look different, says Calicott, and you can be freaked out by that if you want, whatever, but don't at all in any way assume that means that you're better than me or anything like that.
And I think that Calicott also kind of shows what I'm talking about, how all of these gods are fleshed out in really interesting ways. Like they're, to put it succinctly, they are multifaceted. For example, Calicott is, he's very concerned with fear. He wants his followers to spread fear, but it's not in like the malicious way that you think of with most evil deities. It's like, tell children that the forest at night will literally eat them to scare them from going into the dangerous forest at night, to protect them with it. And then you've got that in contrast with, look right here, I'm just going to read this whole sentence. Calicott has a deep love of wild plants and he brews chocolate, coffee, and ciders from jungle fruit. Like, that is such a cool contrast to go instantly from scare children into behaving to, but also give them chalky milk.
Yep.
That's why I really like Calcott. Which deity is kind of did you like from this a whole lot? Which one's your favorite?
I'm a big fan of the three sun gods, Chohar and Luhar and Tlehar. I particularly like their looks. The artwork for them is great. Specifically, I wrote the fourth adventure for the Strength of Thousands adventure path, which features them a lot as kind of not directly, but they're in the background and kind of set up a lot of the background story. So I got to learn about them a lot. And just the sun being there for you, being your buddy, depending on your time of life is really nice. Like one of the aspects of Luhar is that she is dealing with death. She's kind of the setting sun on a life and stuff. And she will help you, like the sun, transitions from being set and eventually coming back. She'll transition, help you transition into death, and mentions that it doesn't have to be a scary thing. It's just the next stage of your existence. And that's totally cool. But also, if you cross her, if you draw her ire, she can make sure that your death isn't a comfortable and peaceful thing that happens, which I always like that kind of aspect with gods. They can be good, but they can also be vengeful or look out for people or strike down those that are evil or cross them.
Multifaceted.
Multifaceted. And of course, I think I and everyone else who's read this book probably likes Lubaiko, who is the goddess of just revolution and blowing crap up. And it's just fun,
Where did she come from? Is she new to this book or has she
She's
been
new to this
around?
book. No, she's new to this book. And I think she kind of came about as part of the Vidrian stuff, all the revolution stuff that was going on. I think it made sense to have a god that might have inspired the rebellion or at least helped fan the flames once the spark was going,
Is would Lubaiku okay, all right. I'm gonna tap your brain here a little bit. I might even plant some seeds if you weren't already thinking about this. Lubaiku's biggest congregation should be in Gaul. Fight me.
In Galt, maybe, yeah. The thing is, so you know how a wildfire can get spread because of the wind blowing in the right way or the wrong way, depending. I think it's very possible that the flames of rebellion that happened in Vidrian can get blown about by Lubaiko. There's a thing that I wrote actually for the Paizo blog that's taking a bunch of these different gods and making small groups, small pantheons that you can worship together. So if you wanted to worship all the sun gods together, you can do the three old sun gods and Serenre as just like one entity. So there was a mixture of Lubaiko and Milani and Cadyn Caelan all working together as gods of rebellion. So, I think Lubaiko's influence is definitely spreading out there already.
I think that's awesome, and I'm really excited to see more of her presence in some of the material coming forward. Now we have to talk about the bestiary of the Mwangi Expanse because there's some really inspired designs in here, and so much of it just like earlier with right hand left hand hyena stuff, right? So much of this is just too creative to not be mythology. I mean, look at how do we say this? Kanona? The Kanona?
Yeah, Kanona. Yes, I think that is definitely from mythology, from what I remember. Which is, they're weird. What are they, Lauren? What are Kanona?
It's hard. So it has the aberration tag, but it looks more like it should be like, you know, undead or something, or like demon, but it's not. You have this woman, and like, do they always have to be women?
No.
They're half human, but not like half human in the way a half elf is half human. No. They're half human, like vertically. like you have one leg, you have one arm, you know, half the head is there, and then the other entire half of the body is just like spectral, but you still can see like just this malicious smile on there. They're just, I don't know, they're a critter of nightmares.
Yes. They have such a unique look, and I particularly like the fact that because they only have half a mouth, you can only understand half of what they say. and they only have one ear, so you only hear half of what you say.
Yeah, that's so creative. Fun. And then you have stuff like the Grootschlong. I'm pretty sure this is actually from mythology too, right?
It is. Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So cool.
Just a big elephant snake. Imagine a big old snake. And then instead of a head, a normal snake head, it just has like the front half of an elephant at the end. And also this elephant has like six tusks, which is pretty ridiculous.
And tell me more about the Mamlambo, because this thing looks kind of like if a crocodile and the Loch Ness Monster were like a thing, you know?
I think that's exactly it. They're just big old Loch Ness Monster style creatures that happen to live in the Mwangi rather than in, I don't know, Scotland. They're just, the Mwangi is home to like dinosaurs and stuff even. So something like this completely makes sense to me. It just looks like a big old swimming dinosaur mixed with a crocodile. Yeah. Sometimes evolution leads to weird stuff. I don't know if this is from mythology or not. I can't recall, but if you were to tell me that someone said, oh yeah, if you go to the right part of Africa, you can see a creature and people call it the Mamlambo and they think it looks like this. We're like, yeah, sure. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Let's just say our favorite monsters from this and we can call it good.
I think I did. those three are my favorite monsters. The Kanona, right, the Drusing, and the Malanda.
Yeah, I'll talk about two monsters real quick. Just because I find them cute. Or fun. I think the Rompo is pretty fun. That one is drawn from mythology, but it's just a monster. It has like this ability to make it so you like get hypnotized, enchanted, or whatever. But it doesn't use it to like attack you or anything. It just does it while it's eating, so it gets left alone. So if it's eating something, it'll start doing this little song, this little cry. And if you hear it, you're compelled to like keep away from it. And then once it's done eating, it'll just run away. It's not a predator. It's just wanting to be left alone. And then the other one is the Zimba, the big healing snake. If you've ever heard a snake referred to as a nope rope.
Yes.
I like to call the Zimba the hope rope. It's a very nice snake. It's very useful. It doesn't like go out and like help people, but it happens to have healing abilities. So if it likes you and wants to help you out, it might decide to bite you and give you its healing restorative that it produces in its body. Or if you find its lair, the waters in which it lives in, can gain some of its healing abilities. So not all these monsters are evil. Sometimes they're just, you know, trying to get by, or there might even be good stuff going on, and that can be the plot hook for a fun adventure. You know, if you need to have someone healed, you could try to find a Zimba's lair or a Zimba itself to help you out. So I like that there's a good mix of things to fight and just things to interact with in the book as well.
So you've now heard three full episodes about the Mwangi Expanse. I want to say it's too many episodes for the Mwangi Expanse, but honestly, like, there's a lot there, and it's all really cool and really exciting. and still pretty dynamic, despite all being one part of the world, right? Mm-hmm. But we're going to leave the Mwangi Expanse. Tune in next time, where we're going to talk about elves. Returning to something a little bit more familiar, because we can't always be in these exotic places. That's all we have for you today. If you like this show or any of our other blogs or shows, please consider supporting us on Patreon.com at patreon.com/nodirection, because it's the support of our patrons that make this all possible. And if you'd like us to cover a specific topic, please join us in the Discord and let us know. While you're at it, make sure to check out the rest of our content on the No Direction Network.
Until next time, I'm Luis.
And I'm Lauren.
Thanks for listening to Legend Lore. And as always, it's been legendary.
I had a big lunch too. You should leave in some of this nonsense I do beforehand just to troll me one time.
Oh, sometimes I do leave in this stuff.
Oh, no.